Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Beau once again to talk about Celtic mythology. This time we're going to talk about the gods, but before we get onto them, we're going to pick up where we left off because we ran out of time last time. So I'm going to talk about the ancestor worship aspect of their religion and philosophy very briefly, and then the human sacrifice part, which I think is something that everyone's interested in, and there is still some debate around that, which I find very interesting. So, without further ado, let's get on to ancestor worship. And more or less, obviously not speaking of all of the Celts, because of course they held different views, but as a general rule, they believed that the spirits of the dead could inhabit the natural world and could be honoured through ancestor worship. They also believed that ancestors could provide guidance, protection and help from them in the afterlife. So they believed that there was an afterlife, but it manifests itself in the material world. There are many cases of belief in things like reincarnation as well, or being, or your spirit becoming part of the environment in which you died is also another possibility, or simply a significant natural landmark like a river would kind of swallow up your soul and you would become part of it. And then therefore the people who are actually alive could then commune in some way, likely through a druid, with their ancestors for things like guidance in the afterlife.
One thing I would say is that quite often historians or archaeologists or academics of all types quite often just say, perhaps with good reason, but perhaps not, it's ancestor worship. You know, they don't really know for sure. Like, just for example, the Easter Island, the original Easter Island religion, cults, the things with the heads, the muay.
Of course,
yeah. Don't really know exactly what they are. And it may well be, it does sort of stand to reason that it's probably some sort of ancestor worship, but we don't know. They just say it's ancestor worship. Or Göbekli Tepe. It's even more mysterious or ambiguous what's really going on there.
Mm.
And they say, oh, it's ancestor worship. It's all ancestor worship. Well, you know, so it may well be the case. I'm not saying it's not. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that quite often when we don't know for sure, because the thing about the Celts that we said in the first one is that they didn't write anything down, really.
Well, so yeah, they didn't believe in it, did they?
So we don't know for sure. We've only got sort of, you know, a few Greek and a few Roman accounts. Mm-hmm. We don't know about it in fantastic detail.
Mm.
And so it may well be that they were deeply involved in ancestor worship, but I don't think we can't say with 100% certainty.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often with any sort of artifacts and things that are ambiguous, we're not sure what we're really looking at. They'll say, oh, it's a religious thing. It's an altar. It's a... So yeah. I just think it is worth noting.
Of course.
That we're not really all that sure about a lot of these things.
Is it like one of those things where you'll get an archaeologist saying, well, we think this was for ceremonial purposes, and you get that so often with just anything that seems impractical.
Mm.
I think that a lot of the time they probably overdo it with that explanation because... Perhaps impracticality is a sign of you being, you know, wealthy and virtuous enough to overcome it. And it's a sign of your status, but it's still used for its main function.
Yeah. Yeah, for example, all over the world, in the Mesoamerican world or the Aztec or Incan world, I find, just an example, I find a big bowl, say, a giant cauldron-sized bowl or something, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not sure exactly its purpose. So they say it had religious significance. Well, okay, may well have done, but you don't know that.
Mm.
Don't know that for sure. And anyway, I just think it is worth pointing out that with the ancient world, especially the ancient world where there's no real literary evidence, and all we've got is essentially are scraps of archaeology. Scraps.
I'll certainly be talking about some of those.
Then we can only really guess. It's more sort of educated guessing.
Mm.
Than anything else. I just wanted to point that out.
My educated guess on this matter is that because they believed that the gods inhabited the physical material world around them, and say there would be a god of the river or a god of the mountain, that that sort of thing. And they also believed in an afterlife. I think it follows that, at least logically, that they would believe that this afterlife was an aspect of the material world, and therefore they would believe that the spirits of their ancestors would be actually physically around them, at least from my understanding of it. I'm sure there would be people that would contest that view, but it seems intuitively correct, even though we can't know for certain.
Yeah, despite all my disclaimers, it is still likely that it's still probably true. You know, like, for example, Stonehenge.
Yeah.
The culture, the religion of the people that built that is lost. It's basically lost. And yet you still can infer all sorts of things from it, can't you? But you just don't know for certain, that's all.
I know that things like ancestor worship, if, you know, the academics are to be believed that it's as widespread as it is, then it would be somewhat of an innate proclivity, wouldn't it? If it's found so commonly around the world, well, that suggests that there's something inbuilt within us, because it's not cultural if it's widely spread. Like, I would argue that there's an inbuilt proclivity to find murder abhorrent. Murder of innocent people, anyway. Because it is found in all societies.
Yeah, it's like worshipping the sun. It's sort of ubiquitous around the world, almost. You know, you get the odd exception where some cultures might put more emphasis on the moon, but nearly, they'd still worship the sun as well, though. So it's like sun worship, for example, or ancestor worship. Yeah, it's a fair bet.
Yeah.
It's a fair bet, still.
Moving on to Irish mythology. I don't know why that's a tongue twister. They're two easy words to say. Samhain, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that. If you're Irish, I'm very sorry. Was a time when the doorways to the other world opened, allowing things like supernatural beings and the souls of the dead to come into the world. And Samhain was essentially a festival of the dead, which was coincidentally held on the 31st of October. So it seems like there is at least some grounding from the mythologies that we've received down the Irish line, which is far better recorded because of the fact that the Romans didn't invade, and also the medieval monks of the time wrote them down. Same with the Welsh, actually. But this seems like something that is in keeping, but then also it conflicts with my understanding of it a bit, in that it suggests that they enter the world, but only for a limited period of time. They believed that the afterworld and the present one, they were closest on this particular date, and therefore they could pass between. But that suggests that they didn't necessarily believe that they were there at all times, their ancestors. So perhaps there was variation, perhaps it was simply on these specific instances that they believed it, or perhaps not at all. Maybe the accounts are incorrect.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the sort of Christian idea of a heaven and a hell, perhaps purgatory, a heaven and a hell, and then the realm of the living, is it's a Christian idea, and cultures, religions that predate Christianity thought of the realm of the dead in quite a different way. Just for example, the thing that springs to mind when you're describing this, talking about this, is the way the Greeks, or in the Odyssey, Odysseus goes down to the underworld. They had a concept of the underworld, but it wasn't really hell. It wasn't like the Christian hell. Both good and bad souls went to the underworld. So it's very, very different. But this sounds a bit more like the Grecian concept of an underworld, and you could go there and come back. I mean, very, very rarely.
Of course.
But Odysseus went down there and came back.
Of course, so they had contact with the Greeks. We know this for certain, because we have things like ancient Greek pottery found in Britain from, you know, 400 BC, things like that. That era of time. I know we certainly had Etruscan, which were obviously Italic, but they were more Greekified, weren't they?
Yeah. And Pythias the Greek, from Marseille, but a Greek man.
Because, almost of course, Massilia was founded by Greeks, wasn't it?
Right, yeah.
Although
yeah.
it's in modern-day France.
Yeah, right, yeah. It was a classical Greek enclave of some type, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, hundreds of years BC, the Greek world definitely had contact with the British Isles. So
yeah, right. So it would make sense that there's at least some sort of common thought on this, because there would have been exchanges of ideas. Obviously, that's lost to history, but it seems feasible. Certainly, Caesar seemed to think that they worshipped their ancestors, because he suggests that they believed in the permanence of the soul and thought that after death you were reincarnated. That's Caesar's understanding of it. Mm. And largely, you can trust Caesar's account on this sort of thing. Particularly on matters like this, where it doesn't seem like there's any clear incentive to smear them as somehow barbaric. It doesn't necessarily seem like something you could frame in that way, does it?
Yeah. The idea of reincarnation as well is very, very, very ancient. You know, I know that, like, the Hindu tradition, which is extremely ancient, is obviously heavily bound up in the concept of reincarnation.
Of course, yeah. And I know that Buddhism as well, I know a bit about the history of Buddhism. They believed that if you reach a point of nirvana, then you can be reincarnated, but otherwise you wouldn't be. Mm. But that's, at least 2000 BC, something like that. This is off the top of my head, so sorry if I'm getting the numbers wrong.
Buddha?
Yeah.
All right. I think because Buddha's a real person, wasn't he? He lived, I think, 500 odd BC, something like that. Might be wrong.
Siddhartha Gautama, wasn't it?
One thing to say about Caesar's account is that most of it is backed up by archaeology and other evidence. Mm-hmm. Most of what he said, one way or another, in the modern era, archaeology has shown, what Caesar said there is in fact completely correct. However, though, there's other lines from Caesar's account, which is obviously wrong as well, because there's one funny, like, it's so wrong, it's funny. There's a line in Caesar's account where he just flatly states that there's been no connection between Britain and mainland Gaul, that they don't trade with each other.
And that's ridiculous, isn't it? That's him trying to portray them as barbaric, though, isn't it? Because it's like, no trade. Yeah. Well, they must be foolish, because the benefits of trade are self-evident.
And he's saying that in sort of the 50s BC. And we know for thousands of years there's been a connection.
Sort of casus belli for invading Britain that they were trading with some of the northern French, northern Gaulish, should I say, tribes.
Yeah, right.
So built in his own...
Self-evidently wrong,
So built in his journal is the means of disproving that it's wrong, because...
Ugh. Historians and scholars have looked over that particular line. It's one particular line I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And they puzzle over it. They're, why did he say that? Most people in his day would have known that's wrong. How is that line in there? It's an anomaly. But you see, there was quite a big trade with pearls. Mm. There were sort of bluish off-colour pearls from Britain.
People knew that they came from Britain, didn't they? Which increased their value, because it kind of ascribed some sort of magical element to it, because, of course, it's the land beyond the sea, isn't it?
And again, the culture, the religion of the Stonehenge builders, the recumbent stones, standing stones all over southern Britain and Brittany, northern France, we know that's the same culture, and that's thousands of years before Caesar lived. So it's just fascinating. Caesar's account is brilliant and mostly, it seems, true and accurate. Mm. But you can't rely on every last word he says. Because he's also got other agendas going on. But
so,
okay.
On the Buddhist question, supposedly he lived 2,500 years ago, which is probably why the number 2,500 stood out in my head. So that would be about 500 BC. did a quick tactical Google for that one. But
whereas the Hindu tradition is much older than that.
Yeah.
Much, much older than
that. I think Buddhism was kind of birthed out of Hinduism, wasn't it? Which is why lots of Hindus also respect the Buddhist tradition, because they see it as part of their own, or an outgrowth of their own.
Yeah, when I went to Cambodia, quite often there are Vishnus that have been re-carved into Buddhas. And then the Camaro smashed them up. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Such a tragedy, isn't it? Like, yeah. Iconoclasm's up there with the extinction of species is one of the worst things that the world can go through.
Yeah. In the modern day, usually Muslims, when they're doing iconoclastic things, it's actually stomach turning. It's actually sickening.
I saw some Pakistanis destroying a Buddhist statue that was 1,700 years old recently, and it made me so angry.
Yeah. There were famously some giant Buddhas carved into the side of a mountain in Afghanistan. And when the Taliban got in the 90s, they blew them up with dynamite. Absolutely priceless things. Iconoclasm is one of the worst things humans do. Mm-hmm.
And on the topic of terrible things that humans do, human sacrifice. There we go. Got a good segue. Yeah. But at the very least. So I'm going to read some Julius Caesar again. He said, "The Britons are extremely superstitious, sacrificing animals and even humans to their gods." This is, of course, from his commentaries on the Gallic Wars again. And he has a much longer section here, which I'm going to read as well. "All the people of Gaul are completely devoted to religion, and for this reason, those who are greatly affected by disease and in the dangers of battle either sacrifice human victims or vow to do so using the druids as administrators to these sacrifices. Since it is judged that unless for a man's life is given back, the will of the immortal gods cannot be placated. In public affairs, they have instituted the same kind of sacrifice. Others have effigies of great size interwoven with twigs, the limbs of which are filled up with living people, which are set on fire from below, and the people are deprived of life, surrounded by flames. It is judged that the punishment of those who participate in theft or brigandage or other crimes are more pleasing to the immortal gods, but when the supply of this kind fail, they even go so low as to inflict punishment on the innocent." So that's an account of both Britain and modern day France. And it seems like if Caesar is to be believed, that they held similar views on human sacrifice. Of course, he's describing what we would call the Wicker Man there as well, which recently rewatched in preparation for this.
The original 60s or 70s version.
73, I think it was, wasn't it?
Because that's a good film.
It is a really good film. It's a good film. I do think it's playing off of the Christian fears of paganism a lot. It's playing off of those tropes and portraying them as far more evil than they would be. But of course, it's meant to be like that. It's the point of the film.
It's a suspense thriller, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they remade it, didn't they, in recent times?
With Nicolas Cage in, yeah.
Right. I watched about an hour of that and turned it off.
I know.
Because I love the original. I don't love it, but it's a good film. It's a very good film. And the remake,
The soundtrack is really good. They did a good job of trying to come up with some original Celtic-inspired folk ballads for it.
Like how Hot Fuzz is some sort of an homage or a comedy parody of it in some ways, isn't it, as well? But the one thing I want to say about human sacrifice is that you might think that, they held life very cheap then. Any culture that does human sacrifice must be very cold and callous, like perhaps the Aztecs or something. Mm. I think you can argue that kind of the opposite is true. No, you want to offer the gods the most valuable thing there is.
Yeah, it's the ultimate sacrifice. When all else fails, then you offer up.
There's nothing more valuable than a human life or even a child's life.
Mm.
So if you offer that to the gods, you're giving them the most valuable thing, in a sense. So I think that's worth noting.
Certainly for the Aztecs, we know that it was considered a great honour to be selected for human sacrifice. I know that's what they would say. Oh, yeah. Don't worry, you're such a hero, you're saving everyone. But it's not necessarily seen with the same taboo as we rightly see it today, I might add.
Yeah. Because again, in the sort of the Greco-Roman world, it was very, very frowned upon. Mm. From the earliest times, human sacrifice was synonymous with being a barbarian. That you are uncultured, uncivilized, if you would even dream of doing such a thing.
The Romans are a bit hypocritical on this, of course, because of the way in which they treated foreign kings in their triumphs, which a triumph is basically a religious ceremony as much as it is a political one, I want to say. I know that's a bit bit out of an out there statement, but
it
has religious significance, doesn't it? The person in the triumph paints their face red to resemble Mars, right? So there's clearly a religious element to it, and at the end they kill the foreign king. So Vercingetorix, for example, was strangled to death at the end of Caesar's triumph over Gaul.
Yeah.
So the fact he can turn his nose up at human sacrifice when he's far more than willing to have it happen when it's in veneration of him.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of contradictions of that type, though, aren't there? For an example, Christians say, thou shalt not kill. But then the Crusaders would, though. When some crusading knights sort of asked their priests about that very thing. Like, didn't Moses say we're not supposed to ever take a human life? And yet the Pope's asking us to do exactly that. So who's right? So yeah, you can have cultures and civilizations that are completely contradictory. That's what humans are like, though, aren't they? Complicated and contradictory.
Well, yeah, hypocrisy is present everyone, more or less. Like it, yeah. I'm sure it's present in myself. I'm not aware enough to know it. It's impossible, though, to be perfectly consistent. So I don't know why I'm pulling them up on it. But moving on to Strabo, he says the Romans put a stop to both. To these customs and to the ones connected with sacrifice and divination, as they were in conflict with our own ways. For example, they would strike a man who had been consecrated for sacrifice in the back with a sword and make prophecies based on his death spasms, and they would not sacrifice without the presence of druids. Other kinds of human sacrifices have been reported as well. Some men would shoot dead with arrows and impale in their temples, or would construct a huge figure of straw and wood, and having thrown cattle and all manner of wild animals and humans into it, they would make a burnt offering of the whole thing.
So again, shades of Wicker Man, isn't it?
Really? It is, yeah.
Again.
Obviously, he would have been aware at this point of Caesar's account, so it's not necessarily supporting him per se, because it could just be using Caesar as a source for the latter thing. The thing that's interesting and relevant here is what he says about striking them in the back with a sword, because I'm going to look at a bog body in a minute, not literally look at it, but talk about it, and we're going to see that we seem to have some sort of archaeological evidence for this, if these are genuine sacrifices, which of course is disputable, because there are some people who would argue that there isn't conclusive archaeological evidence to suggest that there were any human sacrifices taking place at all, because it's difficult to establish the difference between whether it was an intentional sacrifice or whether it was just a murder when you're looking at purely the archaeology.
Or just a secular execution of any stripe, right?
And I think that that's a fair concern, but I don't necessarily agree with the notion that they didn't take place at all. I think that that's probably going a bit too far. I think they were probably less common than you would intuitively imagine. It's not like, oh, I've got a bad back, go cut off that person's head to make me feel better. I don't think it'd be done flippantly. I think it would be done in exceptional circumstances. And I think that the scant archaeological evidence for it is reflective of the fact that it was a last-ditch thing in a lot of cases.
Right, yeah. I mean, they'll make all sorts of sacrifices, not just of human life. For example, quite a lot of archaeological evidence we have that comes from bogs, peat bogs, that preserve things quite well, particularly flesh, organic things. Like good archaeological evidence, like swords and things that are found at the bottom of rivers, because they would quite often throw their most precious things into a bog or into a river.
I'll be talking about those.
Oh, sorry, I've got ahead of you.
That's all right. I'm not going to talk about them too much, though. I'm just going to talk about some examples we found in Britain.
Right, okay.
But onto the Irish. It from both oral, written, and presumably some archaeological evidence as well, there was a tradition of sacrificing ancient Irish kings who were deemed as bad. can't believe I'm going to say this, there have been a couple of cases now of bodies in Ireland of Celtic aristocrats who've had their nipples cut off. And according to Ned Kelly, not the Australian bushranger, but the keeper of antiquities at the National Museum of Ireland, said that sucking a king's nipple was a gesture of submission in ancient Ireland, which seems very counterintuitive to me, but I can understand in that it's harkening back to when you were a baby and you were dependent on your mother.
I can just about see it.
It's very strange. I don't know why that would be the thing to do. What's wrong with bowing or kneeling or prostrating oneself? You don't have to be as weird as that, but each to their own, I suppose. Mr. Kelly says that cutting them would have made him incapable of kingship in this world or the next. So it seems like there was a deliberate reason for this. That's why they believed that the bodies that they found in Ireland were former kings that had done a bad job. There was a mention of a man who was something like 6'7", who had his nipples chopped off and had been seemingly brutally sacrificed. Mm-hmm. And obviously, him being a beast of a man probably explains why he was king as well. Because, of course, being 6'7", that far in the past, is absurd.
It does make sense, though. It does make sense if those were the signs of kingliness or kingship.
Mm.
Well, then cut them off, then. You know, two things spring to mind. In the genocide of Rwanda, where certain, like having very long fingers was a sign of your ethnicity, so they'd chop your fingers off. Mm. Or in the Byzantine era, you couldn't really be an emperor if your nose and ears had been cut off. You just simply couldn't. And so they'd cut your nose and ears off to prevent you from ever...
I'm curious about that, because obviously I know about the golden nose side of things, but what was the significance of the nose and ears?
Well, there wasn't any special significance. It was just that if you were deformed like that,
okay,
it was just proof positive that you were a failure on some level,
mm-hmm.
that you'd failed in your charge of being a ruler to okay. the point where your enemies could have done that to you. Or it's proof positive that, of course, there is an exception, Justinian II, where that happened to him. He was knocked off his perch. He was dethroned.
Mm.
His enemies cut his nose off, sent him into exile. And then years later, he had a renaissance, his career had a renaissance, and he came back. He's wearing a golden nose strapped to his face. So there are it wasn't always the case, but nearly always that's the case. Or if he had a princeling that was a pretender, well, just to make sure he never achieved his dreams, you could cut both his ears off, say.
I know that there's a tendency in ancient cultures to geld people, make them a eunuch so they couldn't become a monarch, obviously, because of the lack of succession, right?
Right, yeah.
So that was another common thing.
Yeah.
But to complicate the Irish dilemma, I suppose, is the fact that there's not really too much mention of human sacrifice in Irish mythology. There's only one clear instance where there is an example of a high king who set up an idol to sacrifice children to, but the druids put a stop to it by murdering him.
Hmm.
So the notion that somehow these human sacrifices were being encouraged by the druids here, at least according to this mythology, seems to be disputed a little bit.
Mm.
I think that certainly the druids' roles as a judge for criminals and things like that, because of course we've got lots of accounts of them supposedly being judicial in who deserves what. So perhaps they were the ones sanctioning the execution of criminals. That's sort of the apologetic side of it. But I think that it's probably likely that they did sacrifice people for better outcomes, better harvests maybe, success in wars.
Once again, we don't know about any of this in fantastic detail because there's no sort of literary evidence, but what does play out throughout all sorts of cultures and civilizations throughout all of history is a friction between the rulers, whether it's a king or a pharaoh or whatever, or just a lord, and their priestly caste.
Mm.
It just plays out again and again and again and again, that there's tension between them. Perhaps in England's one of the most famous cases, Henry II and Thomas Becket. But that's just one tiny example. It's sort of endless. Right there, it seems like there's sort of the fingerprints of something like that going on, that the king wanted to do something, mm-hmm. and his priestly class, the Druids, had enough power in this instance to just be, well, no, we'll bump you off if you try and do that.
Well, I think in that instance, they're probably right. If you create an idol to sacrifice children, you probably deserve to be killed.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, to you or I, right, yeah. Yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.